my father's, you know, everything, when I moved him over from Bend, everything was like, oh, over there, we did it. Oh, Fred Meyer did this. Everything was better in Bend. And now I still think it's Bend.
Yeah.
You're not shoveling a foot of snow at 90 years old.
I did start the tape. We haven't opened the meeting yet. It's now 6:04. We have a quorum. So, well, let me shut off my phone. It was only my daughter. We'll call our, what is this, February meeting of the Westland Public Safety Advisory Board to order. And we will start with brief introductions. I'm Tom Friedland. I am the chair at the moment.
Chris Duncan, recording secretary of the board for the moment.
Judy Wickman, board member.
Garrett Hoffman with the police department.
Peter Mahuna with the police department and the board liaison.
Stephen Myers. Oh, sorry.
Oh, I just, for the record, Gareth, did you say?
Garrett.
Garrett.
Yes.
G-A-R.
G-A-R-R-E-T-T.
Double R, double D, yes.
H.
O-F-F-M-A-N.
Got it. Thank you so much. I got yours.
That's okay. Stephen Myers, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and also wanted to let you know I'm the on-duty public information officer tonight, so if I have to jet, that's why.
Okay. You should have the agenda in front of you for our official members. Any changes, additions, modifications, or do I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Is there a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. We have minutes from our January meeting. And I believe this is the same as that Chris had put together and sent out. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Does anybody have any changes or modifications? Or do we have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, good. We're getting through the pile.
One point of order, since you established a quorum, but could I might be in order to announce the resignation. Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
I figured you were.
Okay.
I needed to get the meeting open before we did that. We did get an email earlier today, about 11:30, from Mike Schofield, who has been on the panel for a while, and he is submitting his resignation because of time conflicts of his own. And so we now have another opening on the board that will have to be filled.
May I comment on that?
Surely.
I asked him if he had any friends at the LDS Church that might be interested in filling his position here, and he said that, Scott, can't think of his last name, who helped us with the emergency fair from the LDS Church. He said he'd be the perfect person, and he might have some people in mind because I put the idea out there.
Okay.
So we might be able to get them to submit an application at the city.
Okay.
Which would be great.
At least he had friends. But you're going to say he didn't have any to recommend. We also got, and I didn't bring it, did I? We have a, oh, here it is, mixed in with Mark's message. Mark Gilbert is not going to be able to be here. You should have seen an email on that. And our new liaison with the City Council, Juliana Walters, is not able to join us tonight because of a conflict with the City Council. So we do have some new faces that we will be interacting with as we move through this year. Brings us to old business, and as Chris and I have been commiserating here just a moment ago, we have heard nothing from the City Council regarding reappointments, so I think we are again putting the board elections on hold for another meeting, unless somebody has a better idea. Okay. So much for that one. disaster preparedness, map your neighborhood. You have anything?
Yeah, I've got several people on board. I'm going to be speaking to the the Rosemont Neighborhood Association meeting, their next one, and they've got about 3 or 4 people who want to host.
Okay.
So that'll be probably 10, 20, 30, 40 homes. And then I still have a new woman from Hidden Springs who wants to do one very soon, and I'm going to be meeting her for coffee pretty soon. And then there's this other one that David Baker met over also in Rosemont, and she is trying to get the sub-captains, as they call them,
mm-hmm.
going. So we probably have about 1, 2...
Almost
three,
a half a
five,
dozen.
Gosh, at least 6 meetings are going to be coming up probably in March and April.
Okay.
So it's going full bore, and I'm sorting through all the literature. I'm finding that there's this balance. I don't know if everybody else has seen this with their professional publications and stuff, but people are just so on their phones and not caring about handouts and literature anymore. But some of the things that we give them that are very useful are not online. So we're still doing physical things from the Department of, you know, Oregon Emergency Management and mm-hmm. things like that. Red Cross has a wonderful brochure that we use all the time. So I'm trying to coordinate those for the people who want them without having, you know, hundreds of extra documents sitting in my filing cabinet in my garage. But for right now, I think...
Are all these items from other organizations
yeah.
with a copyright of some sort?
Yeah, they...
Can we seek whether or not we can have permission to post them and see if we can maybe put it on?
The ones that we use are booklets this thick. It would be too much. Like the Red Cross one is still one of the best documents around, and they're still publishing them.
You were saying that, you know, most people are geared for things online. I was wondering if there's a way we could perhaps expand or create something on disaster preparedness.
Well, Steph would be a good person to ask, because there's one document that you have that you were kind enough to make multiples for me. It's a two-sided thing about what to have in your emergency kit.
Yeah.
Is that something that TBFNR would allow us to put online?
Yeah, no problem. We own we have links to a lot of documents that are from other groups, but that one's one of ours. So, yeah, it's a PDF, and we could make it very shareable.
I find that there's people who really want to get organized,
mm-hmm.
and they really don't want to take the time to read about how mm-hmm. to do it. And they really don't want to go looking on Amazon or mm-hmm. Walmart or whatever and saying, oh, I ought to get a so-and-so. You do see maybe 5% of the people that do that. You know,
right.
My brother's one of them. It's like, he just loved doing the research. Other people are like, tell me what to get and I'll get it.
And
so I'm finding it's all over the place.
Yeah, we've had the discussion back and forth, and I don't think we've ever really done anything moving it forward of having on a city webpage somewhere some information about disaster preparedness with some of the resources that are specific to...
Yeah.
To the city. I just have no idea, since there's been so much turmoil in who is doing community outreach within the city, as far as whatever those roles are. We've had people in acting positions and people getting settled in, that maybe as that settles down is something we want to look at. If nothing else, maybe a page that links to TVFNR, some of the other resources.
Well, don't we still have the position open in the city for the city emergency manager? That hadn't been filled as of a month ago.
That's not been filled.
Okay.
That would be the perfect person once he or she gets up to speed and has caught their breath, that we could say, here's some of the resources we have, and maybe they have a web person who does something for the city.
I assume we do.
We should tell her about it after she gets appointed. Gets appointed.
Don't
scare him off.
I want to say at our last meeting they were talking about they were hiring for Courtney's position, previously Courtney's position. I want to say Councillor Sevelick was saying they were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good step right there, because that's a key
Yeah.
Yeah, and
position.
That's part of what's holding up any movement to do something like that. But maybe we should be at least, kind of brainstorming a little bit on what types of things or what links we want to have on there.
Yeah. Offhand, I can think of quite a few.
Yeah, I mean, I pointed out before, the Irvine Police Department in California has got a rather extensive link on their department page that I came across as looking something up on them. That's got quite a bit of information on it online that, you know, could be as a model as to what to go at or what, you know, draw from them some ideas as to...
Is that the police department of Irvine?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to look into that.
And
TVFNR has just phenomenal notes.
I was, you know, the page almost overwhelms you when you look at all the different things on it, so...
You imagine, this is what we do for our fun stuff. Can you imagine people who are overwhelmed that are going...
Yeah.
I was curious about the county, what they're doing. I haven't gone out to the counties.
It's not quite as
robust
as you would think.
Okay.
Yeah, my liaison over there that I work with, Jamie, she has, you know, she has a certain amount of responsibility, but beyond that, she can't. She's not like the head of it or doing anything, but she's the one who helps get me the information.
Right, but in terms of their website, not that much. That you would want to pass on to others or
you
link?
You know what? I honestly haven't looked at it very much. I've just perused that. I mean, I looked at TVFNR and Red Cross and FEMA. But that is something I would like to look at and figure out if there's some interesting stuff there. So I'll take that on as a responsibility.
Okay. Do we have any other information on other preparedness issues? We kind of dovetailed into that back door with the web stuff. Is there anything else to... add into that topic.
I'm sorry, I had to go out of the room for a...
She just talked about upcoming macro neighborhood potential.
That's meetings. What I was going to say. So yeah, there's still some, but you don't have firm dates yet.
I've got, between Rosemont and Hidden Springs, I've got like at least six that
so kind of
together.
The same that were floating last month?
Yeah, they all put it off with either being sick with bronchitis or weather or the new year or whatever, but now they're all like, oh gosh, we've got to get organized.
Okay.
I even just bought my 50-gallon drum. It's going to be delivered tomorrow.
Now they'll say it's snowing.
Yeah, it'll freeze all over.
Okay. Anything else?
So that's basically it from me.
Our teen driver safety program, we ended up with three applicants submitting for the scholarship. So since we were looking at awarding three, there was really little in the way of a screening process. I sent emails out to the three with a copy to Karen McCoy, our contact with Street Survival, and she in turn sent emails to all of them, and we haven't heard anything back from them yet. So I don't know what the hang-up is. I was going to forward the information to the SRO and see if he wants to try and figure out who or what's going on, if you know they've changed their mind in the month or so. I was disappointed we only had three people from, you know, the promotion we did on it, but then again, I'm not surprised when all of a sudden we don't get any response to those that took the time to write something, submit it, and then they're not responding to it. And we've only got, I think it's first part of March, like the second weekend in March, the not this for coming one, but the following one. So I think it's coming up pretty quick. So
those are people that are trying, that have written what they're supposed to and they're trying to get in. Is there still interest? Because when I mentioned this school a few months ago to our handyman who was doing some repairs at our house, he has a teenage son at Westland, and he said as soon as he heard the word BMW sponsored, it was just like the lights went off. So I think that if we need to get some interest at the school, all we have to do is put BMW sponsored in it, and it'll get
The youth council was to promote it. We had them and the SRO take it to the high schools, whatever they do for their daily bulletin that's read in each homeroom or however it works at this point. I have no idea what they're doing in high school anymore. It's been too many years. That apparently was put out. And we had two responses right off the bat. And then a third came in maybe 4 or 5 days before the deadline, which is the 15th, and then nothing coming back. It could be that there's something in the way of a spam filter with the emails, because I think they're all the high school emails. I'm not sure.
That's interesting.
I don't know, but the SRO's there. He can make the contacts and promote it from there.
I just had a thought. Don't they have like some... like little community vignettes that they show on like Channel 6, Channel 8 locally, ABC affiliates, whatever, like little news.
Yeah, there was one that they did 2016, 2017, I think, by COIN, and we had that available for the Youth Council to see when we took it to them as a promotion, and they, you know, were interested. It was, you know, yeah, we'll promote it, and I don't know what's happened since then.
You think parents would be all over this, and kids are safe driving?
Well, I think the downside might have been that I focused too much on trying to get the word to the high school. We didn't do something to get it out to the community as well, like getting something in the Westland Tidings, some of the next door type social media. I thought that getting the kids interested would be enough, and that they did need the parental permission if they're under 18 to partake in it. I don't know. I mean, once you see what they're doing, the Youth Council is just, you know, wow, yeah, we want to, and you're not exempt from applying. So, I do have the names if anyone wants them. Do you want to put that in the minutes, the ones that were selected? I can give you the emails that.
Now, is there a privacy issue about publishing the names of underage kids?
I don't know.
Because this is a public record, and yeah, I'm wondering if parental permission has to be there.
I'm okay. A little, especially just, they're not confirmed.
Okay,
so
that's fine. We don't
three
have
applicants.
To. And that's fine. I have no problem with that whatsoever.
Still not confirmed. Yeah.
Do you have the SRO's email address?
I have his. Yeah, it's Halverson or something. Yeah. I can't. I always forget it. I know it's there. I just type in a little bit on the address that shows up. Any other old business?
Only that I made an announcement last month about the documentary for the other organization I'm affiliated with called Selling Your Soul about screen addiction, and they had to postpone it due to weather. So it will be shown on March 10th at the Lake Theater at noon.
Oh.
So distracted driving, since we're talking about safe driving, is a big piece of it. And the documentary highlights some of the new research that is showing what the brain is doing now with too much screen time. So
I'm sorry, I'm too busy checking on my email.
Yeah.
Speaking of distractions, that brings us to our presentation. Officer Hoffman, you have the floor.
All right. Give me a second to get this up and going.
Sure.
And I'll get started.
Yeah, I don't think the teenagers are always getting that message about, you know, you can be pulled over for, you know, texting while you're driving and talking on the phone. Because I still see them all the time. And I've been almost cut off several times by them.
I think they're getting the message.
Teenagers,
they're
teenagers, unfortunately.
Well, no, that's true.
That's just it. That's what they're learning. Is that
I mean, it's the mindset in general. I mean, you know, people still talk on their phones, and
you can see people weaving in front mm-hmm. of you that you know are not drunk.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, you know, 10 in the morning. Well, not that someone mm-hmm. could be, but they're weaving around.
That reminds me, I still haven't gotten my Bluetooth to work in the car yet. That was an hour ago. Things changed. The electrons moved.
There's a problem with this drive.
Yeah, it says I don't know why.
It doesn't like you. There you are.
Yeah, reset files. Oh, it was going to order.
No, his drive wasn't showing up before, so.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Huh?
Where's Mike McGrath?
Don't know.
Oh, he just didn't, you didn't check in.
Okay. So just get started. I just put a quick little presentation together on, it was my understanding you guys wanted to hear a little bit about what a DRE is, what we do, and then mainly about marijuana impairment. So that's what I just put a quick little slide together. They're not dynamic slides, they're black and white. I pulled a lot of the information from the Department of Justice slides that they put together for us to teach to other officers. So that's what it's going to be based off of. I'm going over a lot of information very briefly just to kind of give you guys an overview. So stop me if you have questions on something or want more detail. I'll stop and go into that. I'll pass these around. These are just a couple props. I'll talk about these as we go, but these are a couple. These are the some of the information that we use in our evaluations and what the DRE program looks at in regards to drug impairment and what we do. So a little bit about me. My name is Garrett Hoffman, as we went over earlier. I've been at Westland PD for about 4 years. Prior to that, I was in a non-sworn position with the Monmouth Police Department for about a year and a half. Here at Westland PD, my roles include drug recognition expert, I'm a field training officer, currently assigned to the traffic position. That's been my favorite thing so far. I'm an officer in charge, and then I'm also a standardized field sobriety test instructor. So that's, like I said, that's where I got some of these slides from, is I instruct the standardized field sobriety test to other officers. So that's a lot of the information you guys are gonna get is from what I teach. In regards to that. So drug recognition expert starts with training. It really actually starts with an application. We put in an application once you get out of the police academy and you start enforcing DUIs, going to DUI crashes, and you get some experience in the field. For me, when I applied, I had about 3 years on. I'd done about 100 DUI investigations myself, and I put in my application to DRE school. They review that, and then you go to the class. The classroom is a 2-week classroom portion. At the end of that, it's a written test. And then after the classroom portion, you go to a 1-week certifications, they call it. The certifications are in downtown Portland, and they actually bring volunteers off of the street who are impaired under all kinds of substances, and we do our evaluations on them and practice making what we call our calls, or the drug category we believe they're impaired under. Once we do enough certifications accurately, we have a very long final exam. Took me about 7 hours to complete, and then we are a certified drug recognition expert. It allows us to, one, do these evaluations in DUI cases that involve drugs, not just alcohol, and it also allows us to testify in court and be seen as an expert in court. That's why the training is kind of as extensive as it is. And then the evaluations are what we actually come and do from day to day in these DUI cases where someone is not impaired by the traditional alcohol DUI, it's drugs. And we come and do this evaluation process we're going to talk about. This is the evaluation. This is what the evaluation consists of, and this is on the back of that sheet that I'm passing around. It's a 12-step evaluation process to be considered the DRE examination. It starts with the breath alcohol test. So to kind of just sum up how this would go, an officer stops somebody or responds to a crash, and they see that somebody's impaired, they shouldn't be driving. They make that call, they bring the person in to do a breath test. When the person gives the breath test, it's a 0.00 or a 0.02, so very little alcohol or no alcohol. They call for a drug recognition expert. Then myself or another DRE from around the state comes, and they'll start by interviewing the arresting officer, get the details about why they're here, and then we start our examination. In the examination, we will check pulse, we'll check their vital signs, their blood pressure, their body temperature as well. And then we do some physical tests with them. Some of them, you know, you've probably seen on TV, where we check the eyes, the horizontal gaze, the nystagmus. We'll do the walk and turn test where they take heel to toe steps down the line, the one leg stand test. There's the finger to nose. They have to touch the tip of their nose. We do those physical tests, and then a lot of the evaluation, like I said, is around the vitals, checking the blood pressure, the pulse rate, the body temperature. Those drug categories are going to do different things with that. And then also the pupil size. Different drug categories will dilate the pupils. It will constrict the pupils, and it will affect how they react in light. So like one of the tests in the evaluation, we shine direct light at their eyes, and we see how their pupils react. And drugs, different drug categories will affect that. So that's the dark room examination there. Muscle tone, some categories will make muscle really rigid and stiff. Others, it'll make it very squishy and flaccid, and we can kind of feel the difference by feeling them. And then we get to the end and we give our opinion. So if we, for example, so our opinion is stated in the drug categories that we use. So if we believe, for example, somebody, if we know they used meth, we will say we believe they're impaired by a CNS stimulant or a central nervous system stimulant. We won't actually say meth. We say the category that they're impaired under. So these are the drug categories that the DRE program uses. The drugs might fit into these slightly differently than you see them in the medical field or in other areas where they categorize drugs. These are categorized for impairment and how we see impairment. The first is CNS stimulants. The common one is, CNS depressants. The common one in that is alcohol. Other ones are Xanax, some prescription pills, antidepressants. Those oftentimes fall in the CNS depressants. Then there's CNS stimulants. That category is meth. Another common one we see is Adderall. And then hallucinogens, these are just like they sound, the drugs that cause hallucinations. So that's mushrooms, LSD, and then kind of some of those other party drugs, as we call them, that people use in that environment. And then dissociative anesthetics, the common one from that was PCP. We don't see that as much anymore. What we are seeing now, I've seen several times, is what they call robo-tripping, where you drink a lot of Robitussin, cough medicine, and if you drink enough of it, you'll get high. It's similar to a PCP high. They'll appear very drunk out of it, sometimes do crazy off-the-wall things. They won't feel pain. Dissociative anesthetics, that kind of how you break that term down, it dissociates pain from the mind and the body, so they just don't feel pain. It doesn't get relayed to them, so that's how you hear those stories about people jumping out of windows and running still and doing crazy stuff because they just don't associate it. Narcotic analgesics, that is heroin, opiates, oxycodone, morphine, all those pain medicines, prescriptions. That's the narcotic analgesics. Inhalants, that's huffing, so sniffing paint, gasoline, flipping whipped cream bottles upside down, getting the air out of them, that's all inhalants. And then cannabis has its own category, so marijuana does some different stuff to the body. It's pretty accurate with when we do our evaluations, what we see. But it's different from everything else, and that's why it kind of has its own category. This is our matrix. This is what I'm passing around. Like I said, as we do our evaluation, what we see from people will start to fit into these different categories. Some people will have multiple categories on board. Some people will just be one category. The most I've called once is three. I've got results back with people with four categories as well. So that's where this program gets a lot more complicated when you have multiple categories because those start to overlap. But this is what we come back to and look at when we finish our evaluation. So notable tools we use, this isn't all we use, but we have the blood pressure cuff to check the blood pressure. Then we have the thermometer, like I said. And then UV light, we have a little UV pen light, and this part's pretty cool. Different drug residue will glow under UV light. So cannabis is a really, really common one. It'll glow pinkish purple on the back of their tongue. And you'll see it with everybody with all the cannabis impairment. It'll always be pinkish purple on their tongue under UV light. It's a dead giveaway. So the UV light's a pretty cool tool. We're still figuring out, like, cocaine's kind of a bright blue, but a lot of those other drugs that we don't see as much as cannabis, we're still getting the colors figured out kind of, but cannabis is always that purple, pinkish glow. And then this is the pupillometer. I passed that around. That's how we judge people's pupil size when we measure it in the dark room examinations. We put that next to their face and correspond the circle, and then that gives us the millimeter measurements, which then tell us if they're outside the DRE average range or within that. And then if they're outside the range in regards to the pupil being larger, that's where you get the dilated on that form. And then if they're smaller than that DRE range, that's where you get the constricted. So as far as marijuana goes, this slide, like I said, is from the DOJ curriculum. And as you can see with the verbiage on here, this is kind of a battle that we have, is learning to enforce these DUIs when we come across them. Because it's different in a way, recognizing it is different than alcohol impairment. It's not your typical drunk person that you see. So getting officers to feel confident to do these investigations is something we're trying to teach this program for. And you can see with this, you know, you already have the tools to enforce marijuana in the U.S. This is part of the curriculum that we're trying to teach because it's difficult and it's different than an alcohol DUI. And then the bottom line, this was always taught by someone from DOJ who teaches these classes, Deanna Ryerson. She always calls marijuana the ranch of all drugs because it is with everything. My DRE calls are almost always cannabis and something else, cannabis and CNS suppressants. Cannabis is with everything. So it shows up in almost all of our DUIs, and then interestingly enough, without going off a complete rabbit hole, many of these DUIs, they come back and they blow a 0.09 BAC or 1.0 BAC. That's an alcohol DUI. We don't take it any further, we're done. They blew over the legal limit, we're done. But many of them are also high on marijuana, and that kind of is not reported at all because if it was an alcohol DUI, we won't take it any further. But we know from being with those people, they look like a 0.22 DUI, not a 0.09, but because they're a multi-category. But if they blow over an 08, that's all we do. That's as far as we go. So. Just kind of an interesting thing with that and how marijuana is always mixed. Ingestion, the common ways people are taking in marijuana is through smoke. They will smoke your typical joint. They'll smoke it through a pipe. They do dabs, and then they use the vape pens. So the dabs is where they heat up some concentrated marijuana and dab it onto a hot kind of metal item, and it vaporizes it, and then can smoke the smoke off of it. And then orally, edibles, and then there are some pill form marijuana as well. So the dabs, the notable ones on here is the dabs. That's how you get some very concentrated marijuana into your system with very high THCs, and that's where you start to see this marijuana impairment that isn't consistent with what we see as the stereotype of marijuana, where they might be off the wall crazy and hyped up and almost look like somebody high on meth more than that droopy, calm marijuana stereotype. That's the really high THC that makes kind of takes it a whole different direction. And then edibles, those, we go to calls. I've gone to probably a couple calls now where people think they're overdosing on marijuana from the edibles because you eat like a cookie. The serving will be half a cookie of edible marijuana. They eat half the cookie, nothing happens because it takes a while to get in your bloodstream. So they eat the rest of the cookie because nothing happened, and then it all hits them at once and they think they're going to die. So that's the interesting thing about edibles. Some of the symptoms we look for on the body with marijuana impairment, bloodshot eyes, dilated pupils, that slow deliberate speech, but like I said, sometimes that's going to be opposite if it's a really high THC, droopy eyelids, eyelid tremors, their eyelids will sit and shake. I've got a video coming up, as long as it works, it'll show those. And then body tremors, their muscle groups will shake. And those, I'll usually point these things out to people when I'm talking to them so that they'll be more honest with me. And usually people will say, oh, well, it's cold out, I'm shivering. And body tremors are different than shivering. Usually how I explain it is they're almost opposite of shivering. So shivering, you will, like when you're standing here and it's cold, you'll shiver. But when you go to do something like do the long leg stand, you can usually pretty much cut out your shivering in the muscle groups you're using. You might be up here shaking, but you can stand on one leg. The tremors get worse in the muscle groups that you use. So when you go to balance on this leg and hold this leg up, that's where you're going to see the tremors. Those legs are going to start to shake because they're using those muscle groups, and the tremors get worse. So that's really how you can see the difference in the shivering versus tremors. And then, of course, odor, and then coating on the tongue. A lot of times they'll have a greenish-brown coating on the tongue that we look for. So I'll see real quick if I can get this to work. Kind of see her eyelids when she closes them just kind of sit there and shake. And that's not what they would normally do. They would normally just sit there still. And that's something they can't control. And the body tremors will be similar to that as well. They can't control them, and they just kind of sit there, and the muscles will kind of sit there and shake. Some other pictures, this is a good shot of the droopy eyelids, where about half the color of the eyes is gone, half the pupil is gone, you can't see it. The eyelids are drooping down there. The bottom of the eyes, that's where you get the really red eyes. A lot of times, their actual eyes that you see when they're just looking at you might not be all that red, but if they pull it down below there, underneath there, where it's been protected from the air and stuff, will be real red. And then that shot of the tongue is showing some raised buds from taking in the hot smoke. It'll raise their taste buds up. And then that's where, too, you'll see that coating when they stick their tongue out like that. So for symptoms of marijuana use, they feel a user will typically feel the symptoms and exhibit signs for about 2 hours. So for up to 2 hours, they know they're feeling the effects. They know they're there, but for up to 24 hours, they'll exhibit signs of impairment without knowing that they're still having those effects. And this is where marijuana gets really tricky and gets some people in some DUI situations where they don't think they're still impaired, but us doing tests on them, we still see all the signs of impairment, even though they're not aware of it. Marijuana is a tricky thing. It's very easy for it to become people's kind of normal level, but their normal level is actually impaired, and they don't know it. So marijuana enters the body, the first thing it does is go to the bloodstream. Once it enters the bloodstream, it's not there very long. And this is where we get into how we test for marijuana. So there's two ways. We either test blood or we test urine. Enters the blood, goes to the brain, and then pretty quickly, the body starts getting it out of the blood and putting it into the fat. And it stores it in the fat. So blood test, if you get it quick, would be a more accurate level of how much is in the body. But that goes away very quickly, and usually we don't have that ability. So it gets stored in the fat. And then this is where you hear people worried, well, I used marijuana a week ago, of course I'm going to have it in my urine. That's because it stores the fat and it continues to release over time, and then the body gets rid of that out of the urine. And so it will continue to show up in the urine. And so that's an ongoing thing with how to test for it, but those are the two ways, that's the two places that you find it in the body. And like I said, it doesn't last in the blood very long, and even though it's out of the blood, doesn't mean it's out of the body. They're still feeling the effects. It just leaves the blood quickly to get into the fat. This slide is talking about what it means by looking past the SFST clues. Is there set clues with these tests? Like, for example, the walk and turn. Some of the clues that we look for is if they step offline, if they miss heel to toe, they raise their arms. Some of the other clues that we look for is taking the wrong number of steps, starting too soon before they're told to. With marijuana impairment, it's very common that you're going to see the clues that go along with following directions, as opposed to not so much of the physical stuff. So you might see that they'll start the test before they're told to. They're told to stand in the instruction position, which is heel to toe like this, and they'll just step back out, and you have to tell them to get back in it. And then they'll step back out, tell them to get back in it. Following directions, forgetting what they're supposed to do, taking 9 steps out and stopping, and not remembering to turn around and walk back. That's more common, the impairment that we see with marijuana, as opposed to falling over, losing balance, falling down, stuff that you might see with a drunk person. This is an example of what we call lack of convergence. This is an eye test we do where we bring the pen in towards the bridge of their nose, and they're supposed to follow it and see if their eyes cross. Cannabis is very indicative of causing your eyes not to be able to cross. And so that's what it would look like. He's trying to follow the pen in towards his nose. That eye was able to track in. The other eye just stays out, staring straight ahead. And then again, how we measure, how we quantify our results with marijuana is through the urine. With marijuana in the urine, what shows up is 9-carboxy-THC. That's the metabolite of marijuana, or THC. So with a urine test, that's either there or it's not. So if somebody's body is getting rid of that out of their fat stores, it's going to be in their urine. That's how it leaves the body. And that can be present for quite a long period of time, depending on how often they use. With the blood, we get a nanogram measurement in the blood, and it stays in the blood for a short period of time. So we have to get that result quickly, and it's quickly dissipating out of the blood. So blood is much more time sensitive, but it is more accurate. We can get a measurement. Urine, it's either there or it's not, and it's just the metabolite.
Question.
Yes.
I mean, we all know universally about legislation passed as far as a legal limit for alcohol. Are there laws? Have they established laws on the books? I mean, 9-carboxy. I just don't know if that correlates with a 0.0.
Yeah, and that's
the other.
That's the tricky part with marijuana.
That's what I'm wondering. When you go to court, then what?
There's no test.
I think Colorado.
Or standard.
I think Colorado has set a nanogram amount, but it's tough, and the reason it's tough is because of this short duration in the blood.
Okay.
Marijuana enters the blood, and then it wants to leave it. It wants to get into the fat, and so it will be out of the blood quick. And the people they're still impaired completely, but it's not going to show up in the blood. So that nanogram amount drops quick. And so depending on were they involved in a crash, transported to the hospital, how long does it take to get this blood draw, you might be under that nanogram amount before you can get your blood draw, and they were way above it at the time of the crash. And so that's the tricky thing with setting the amount. With how things are now, we just really articulate the impairment that we see at the scene, and we have a DRE come examine them, and then we have the results to say, well, yes, they have marijuana in their system. It would be nice to come up with an amount, but it's going to need a more streamlined process to get the blood. Like other states, I don't know if it's Colorado or Arizona that have the amount. I think they also have their DREs draw the blood. So they will do a DRE examination, and then the last part of that is they actually draw the blood themselves. For Oregon, we have to call AMR to come draw the blood for us, which usually requires us to do a warrant. And so it's another hour to 2 hours after the DRE examination that we would get the blood. So if we can streamline that process, we can maybe set an amount. But that's that difference in time is what we struggle with. And that's what this slide was kind of touching on. Was I think my email asked to do this. One of the questions posed was if we can predict the amount of impairment with marijuana. And there's kind of, depending on how you look at that question, there's a yes or a no. Most of the time, can I walk up to a car and see somebody and know that they're going with me? But most of the time, because you can just tell it when you look at them. But whether we know whether that's going to be a high nanogram amount or not, that's different. Because depending on, it all depends on the THC level, like dabs versus smoking a joint, how often they use, their tolerance, how their body reacts and processes it. It's all over the board with where someone's nanogram amount might be and to where their impairment might be. So it is very easy to spot them when they're high and know that they should be driving a car, but where they're going to fall on that nanogram scale is different, because some people use all the time. They wake up and they start smoking and they smoke throughout the day. Other people do it kind of like people drink. It's just a recreational thing, and it affects each person differently with how you use it. So that's kind of the struggles that we have with quantifying that and getting the results. Yes.
I don't know the terminology for the different marijuana things. That we have a neighbor with multiple sclerosis, and she uses the one that helps her with pain but doesn't make her high. Would that stay in her bloodstream if she was in an accident and used it 2 or 3 days before, and she had absolutely, she wasn't high at all, but she just had it in her system? Does that stay?
Yeah, so that's
still impaired.
Huh?
I mean, even the one for pain can still impair.
But I mean, if it's several days
so
later.
That's an interesting thing. The medical marijuana has been pitched as, you know, needed. There's a drug called Marinol that is all the things of marijuana that help with pain and anxiety and everything else without the THC that makes you high. So THC, the only purpose of THC is to make you high. That's really all it does for you. There's other substances with marijuana that have that calming effect. They do help with anxiety. They do help with pain. There are medical uses for it, and it's called Marinol. But the THC makes you high. There is a true medical way of using it. The other way of getting it and smoking it and getting high off of it has been kind of pitched as medicinal, which I guess technically there is medicinal properties to it, but there is another way to get those medicinal properties. Yeah. So no, that it would not be seen as THC in our system. It would show up, but it wouldn't be that 9-carboxy THC being metabolized out. So it's different. Yes.
I do have another question. If you stop somebody, this is not the marijuana question, but if they have been in an accident and they are on, legally prescribed drugs like Adderall for attention deficit disorder, or blood pressure medicine, that can change the pupils substantially. I've seen people's pupils are so tiny, you just wonder what blood pressure medicine they're on. Does that, when you take that into account, you can have somebody with bloodshot eyes from allergies, you can have pupil dilation from legal drugs. So you just have to look at all these pieces and figure this person is acting stoned, but they've got some of these symptoms. I mean, is that part of the process?
Yeah. This process is based on everything we're seeing. So just because somebody has red eyes doesn't mean that they're impaired automatically. I stopped one lady that had some sort of medical thing going on. Her eyes were almost beet red, bloodshot, all of it. And it was a medical thing. But I will tell you, the constricted pupils, there's only one category that does that, that's narcotic analgesics, which would be pain medicine, so that's probably somebody using oxycodone.
Also, it's not the blood pressure medicine.
Blood pressure medicine is a CNS suppressant will constrict the pupils. So when you see those really tiny pupils, that's a narcotic analgesic. But yeah, we look at all those things. It's totality of everything. And the DRE, part of the DRE process is one of the calls we can make is medically impaired. There are stories of DREs around the state that have come in to do evaluations and realized that the person actually has a brain injury. I think one of the DREs in my class found somebody with a brain tumor and had them sent to the hospital. So there is a medical impairment call that you can make, because sometimes people are, there is a medical issue and it, you know, at the scene, we don't know what's going on. Somebody's just out of it, and we don't know what's going on, and so figuring that out is also what the DRE process can be. Yes.
Thank you.
I was just curious if there is a, something is happening in the driving to first draw your attention to check something out. Does, with a particular substance such as marijuana, does it tend to be less aggressive driving, that it's more the weaving rather than speed, or is it just the same as the alcohol? What's the driving anomaly that...
That's the slow driving type stuff. That's kind of a more of a myth kind of. They've done studies, and basically across the board, DUI drivers, the top thing is speed. They're all speeding. The reason for DUI...
And you're saying the same whether it's drug or alcohol,
yeah.
Speed
pretty much
is
across the board,
DUI, the common denominator?
The most common one is speeding.
Okay.
I've had some personal marijuana DUIs that have involved, stopping way past the stop line, and just doing kind of weird stuff, not following rules of the road.
Right.
But... for the most part, many of them will be speeding, they'll blow red lights, stuff like that. So it's not this super slow driving. Sometimes it is, but also sometimes drunk people are too. It kind of just all depends on the person and how they're being affected. So, any other questions, guys?
It's just, I'm still kind of going back to that, the drug versus alcohol, as you're weaving through the legal process, is it getting easier, harder, about the same, bring this up? Because you're beginning to see a greater prevalence, but is it equating
the thrust behind the DRE is that it's becoming more of a challenge. You want the expertise of somebody to make that call.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a challenge. They're going to come up with nuances to legal defense. And they're going to have to come up with more tools for the DRE to use.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the DRE evaluation process helps in these. And they are, I've been successful in them. They are more difficult, though. And typically, it comes to explaining it to a jury, because what most of the people in the community see as marijuana is the marijuana from the 70s and 80s. The THC content back then was like 1.9% on average. Now, the flower, the bud, smoking a joint now is like 15%. And then these concentrates are 95-99% THC. So it's a completely different, drug, it's a completely different high than it was back then. So that's kind of the thing that we try to explain to juries and help people understand, is that this is not the marijuana from back then. And because some people have a hard time believing that somebody can be that high, that they did whatever it is this person did. And trying to explain that this is completely different stuff now. And especially with those concentrates where it's 95% THC, that's almost an entirely different drug. It even looks different in how they're high. from smoking, so.
Not your father's marijuana.
No, but that's a really interesting it's thing about the demographic of the jury, you know,
yeah.
All of that aspect of it in terms of trying to keep the public safe.
Yeah.
So.
This has been very educational.
Good. Yeah. No, I mean, it's like I said. I mean, there's tons of information on all this that we try to go over. Marijuana it's been complicated, but it kind of got legalized before the state was really ready to enforce any of this stuff.
Kind of thing.
And so they're trying to catch up a little bit. But it'll be interesting to see what Colorado, I think it's Colorado that has this nanogram level. It'll be interesting to see how that works for them. Mm-hmm. But I think they have more streamlined processes getting there as well.
Thank you,
Karen.
Thank you.
We have any thoughts on other items we'd like to learn about in the coming year? And again, not necessarily bring them up tonight, but be thinking about it. Do we have any updates from the PD?
We were in the process of hiring three. We have extended final offers to two people. The third one is doing his medical and psych evals this week. We will likely hire all three of them on March 18th, and they will ship off to the police academy. April 15th. So
you found some slots.
Excited about that. Huh?
Because you didn't have slots at the academy last.
We have confirmed the first two slots. We can't confirm a slot for somebody until they finish medical and psych. The academy will not, hold a spot for anybody.
Yeah.
But so we should have all three of them in this upcoming class. Which can't remember the last time we've had three people from Weston in one class. So that'll be very exciting for them. Our code enforcement officer is back on limited duty. She started, I think today, back on. So she is working through the mail. Some of our code enforcement staff had been either sent off to patrol officers or just kind of sat for her. So I think the public would be excited to have the code enforcement officer back full time. And that's all I got.
The replacement, because wasn't there going to be some overlap?
They haven't. They're still. She's going to retire.
Yeah.
But because of her time off, that has been delayed because she wasn't getting her time in her purse when she was doing that. So
sure.
Her retirement date has been pushed back.
Okay.
She hasn't given us a date yet, but we're also not totally pushing.
Sure.
Budgetary reasons, they want us to
get
a date for her before we hire her.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Do you have Laura?
Yeah, we'll start with retirement since we're talking about that. If you don't know, one of our lieutenants here, Mike Thorne, he's been a lieutenant at the station here in 5-9 for a long time and really well revered. He's going to be retiring, and they're doing a gathering, so if you know anybody that has known him or had great interactions and wants to see him off, on April 10th from noon to 5, they're going to be having a little retirement party over at the station there for him. So, also wanted to bring you probably saw Rosemont Ridge Middle School. We had a call for service up there in which we had a good opportunity to work with school officials. PD was there as well. It was a natural gas leak, and it was officially determined that the regulator had malfunctioned and was leaking. So they had to dismiss all the students and eventually decided to move them over to the church next door and then cancel classes and do a reunification with parents and send them home. So it's always a good test to see how all the partners work together, because that's not just one player. It's a bunch of different entities working together to execute that, and it went pretty smoothly.
Did they actually have the rotten egg smell and they got everybody out? Like
that's how it was initially detected, and then everybody did the right things and moving quickly and reporting as they needed to. So yeah, we work with, and then also natural gas. Northwest Natural Gas is also a player in that, and they help determine where the leak is and whether it's safe to re-enter the building. In that case, they decided best to send everybody home for safety.
And this was where, Rosemont?
Rosemont Ridge Middle School.
Ridge.
About a week ago.
Middle school.
Yeah. 15th, I want to say it was a Friday. So they got an early weekend. Then along those lines, this time of year, a good reminder to make sure that your carbon monoxide detectors are working. On that note, with people being indoors a lot, home heating being a key component, and people using lots of different means to do that, that's an important thing to be checking this time of year. So I'm guessing all you guys are smart, but good to pass that message along. And then, I wanted to share, we have in April, we're going to do a career day. These are an opportunity, so if you know anybody that's interested in the work within the fire service, that... this is an opportunity to get a lot more insight into what that entails. So we have programs that help kind of bring in high school students. This is a little bit more 18 and older, so this is a little more definitive in what they want to do. But we found a lot of great candidates that have come through that because when they understand the job and what's going to be performed, they're usually set up for more success. So... the last thing I did want to offer is I'm going to be doing a number of presentations to our neighborhood associations and throughout our community regarding this May. I mentioned we're going to be on the ballot for a renewal of our funding measure. So sometime between now and May, if you'd be interested in me doing just an abbreviated, I can make it even 5 minutes for making a short evening, I'd be happy to do that for you. Just kind of talk about how are we funded and then what the funding has paid for in the past and would pay in the future.
And so. This would be for what type of situation you'd be able to do the 5 minute presentation? Is this the neighborhood?
Us.
Or us?
Us.
Yeah, I just wanted you to know I'm doing it all around, so if you'd like to have it here, I'd be happy to do that for you.
You want to do it next meeting, March 25?
I could do that. Actually, let me confirm that I'm here, but yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll be here. Put me down.
Okay. See if I remember when I did the agenda.
For your career day, it's not mandatory to have a college degree to become a fireman?
No.
Fire person, sorry.
Yeah, you can be in the process or even, just considering.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, we don't have any community here tonight. We just announced our next meeting. Is there anything else under good of the order or last-minute comments? Or are we ready to escape and dodge the snowflakes?
Dodge the ice.
May I entertain a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Anyone opposed to adjourning?
We'll
put backwards.
And
that brings us to a close at 7:07. Where's my stop button?